Station number 1663, Reel 2.
Dr. Martin, Reel 2.
Well, the reality of those days meant that the Czech army was retreating from its advanced positions. We were confined to barracks, and the agreement was that all ambitions of extending the German sphere of influence would now be fulfilled, and the rest of Czechoslovakia would be allowed to exist, and the Sudeten German part would be added to Germany, like Austria had been in the past. Well, of course, it was quite obvious to everybody in place there that this would not happen. The future, that is the complete occupation of Czechoslovakia, was only a matter of time before it happened. And I felt that my future in Czechoslovakia was becoming very dubious. I went to Prague and I had to decide what to do. I had an uncle who was a quite well-known surgeon. He wrote one or two textbooks.
Were you still in the army at this time?
Well, I was. Yes, I was in the army, but it was only a matter of demobilizing us. It was a matter of days or weeks, and I was in Prague, not even in uniform, though I hadn't been officially discharged. But at that time, my uncle received an invitation to come to England to study for a British qualification. And he was in his 50s, and he, whoever approached him, wrote back that this was not for him, and he felt very flattered. But the sort of people they want is newly qualified doctors, and he suggested they should look me up. And so I received an invitation to come to England to study medicine at the Westminster Hospital in London.
When would this have been about?
The end of the year.
End of 38?
Yeah, 38, you see. Early 1939, yes. Well, then Czechoslovakia was occupied by German troops. I often thought that there was a parallel between the fate of Anthony Eden in this country and Eduard Beneš in Czechoslovakia. They were both trusted as excellent lieutenants carrying out the wishes of Mr. Churchill in this country and Thomas Masaryk in Czechoslovakia. But they had not the qualities of leadership required to be in charge themselves. There was a joke going at the time in Czechoslovakia when the Germans just ruthlessly took over the whole country. Eduard Beneš gave a little speech, and on the radio you heard that he had a plan And the joke was he didn't have a plan but a plane. And he left the country. And that was the end, you see, of a stewardship, which was very, very unsatisfactory and tragic, you see. But anyhow, at that time, the studying in England required documents to permit you to leave Czechoslovakia and travel through Germany to England. And it was often refused if you were between the age of 20 and 40 and had an occupation like doctor, vet, engineer, any sort of useful occupations like that in young people were a reason for not allowing you immigration. And I decided, therefore, that I wouldn't like to stay and then possibly be one day called up in the German army. I saw the war coming quite unavoidably within months or certainly a year or two. And I was further influenced by the fact that my father had been temporarily arrested and sent to, what the Germans called Schutzhaft, protective custody, as a potential saboteur. He was only about 4 or 5 days under detention and then released on condition that he would leave the country within a week.
Why should they have thought that he was a potential saboteur?
I don't know. He was obviously on a list, you see, with other people. And, if you want to reason, possibly, he was a very experienced engineer dealing with communications. And if he were not considered loyal or not friendly to the Germans, that might have been part of the reasoning. But anyhow, I know he was released, and he was leaving the country, and he was sponsored to go to England, and actually he worked for a firm called Plessy for most of the war.
Did you see the Germans come into Prague yourself?
Yes, yes, yes.
What did you see?
Well, I saw once a German troop carrier going through one of the streets of Prague, and somebody on the pavement, a youngster, was sort of making rude gestures and spitting, you see, and he looked at them, and they stopped the truck and grabbed him and took him along. So they were not out to win us over. They were occupying troops.
Was there much spitting and gesticulating at the troops?
Well, that was an incident I saw, you see. There were certainly very great, resentment, particularly as the whole nation felt really betrayed by the actions and attitudes of the Sudeten Germans, who people felt had been treated with the greatest respect and compassion for the previous 20 years, ever since the state had been created in 1918.
How did the Germans behave in Prague at first?
Well, you didn't really see much of them. They were just in charge. You saw the swastika everywhere, which was not pleasing, and you saw them walking about and with a certain swagger. They were just the Superman nation.
What was the process of your having to go to offices to try to get out?
Well, I had, through my having gone to school and university on and off for years, I had various contacts amongst medical students who were actually what you would call Sudeten Germans, and who were very pleased and happy about what happened. I should say here that it was very obvious that they gained great advantages, because if you removed in the sort of career structure of medicines and the hospitals all the Jews, you would find there were plenty of opportunities of advancement. And the same applied to the sort of Czech nationalists, you see, who made it very clear that they would never serve under or with Germans being in charge of certain institutions. But I had a personal friend who appeared to me completely apolitical, as I was, and we just studied side by side and prepared ourselves to endless exams. And he was the son of a headmaster of a school somewhere in the borderland in the Sudeten district. And he suddenly saw the light and felt that he should assert his German, how shall I say, ancestry. And to my amazement, and I was appalled to hear from him, that not only did he join the Nazi party, but he volunteered to join the SS, the stormtroopers, as a doctor. He had just qualified about it. And this was partly just a sort of silly assertion of juvenile, how shall I say, aim to be different. The black uniform and high boots and the death scowls on his collar and the pretense that the SS were the best troops in Germany, the absolute elite. It all influenced him. But anyhow, he claimed, wrongly as it turned out, that he had any number of friends amongst the German occupying forces. And he said, "Harry, oh, don't you worry, I get you this exit permit, which I needed to travel to England." But of course he didn't get it.
So what did you do?
Well, I felt by that time, my mother had died, and my father at that time I assumed would be in England, but I hadn't heard from him yet. But I thought I would go to England and study medicine, join him, study medicine at the Westminster, and to do so I would cross illegally the border into Poland, which was dead easy from Moravia, because this was all part of the Habsburg Empire, and big country estates sort of spread into the next country, you see, and no problem at all. And so I decided I would go to Poland, from there I would fly to Stockholm, and from there fly to England. And so I left Czechoslovakia illegally in the spring. It must have been April or May, 39. I should tell you here, memory is such a selective thing. I never forget the night of crossing the border illegally, because I had a local man as a guide, and in pitch darkness we crossed into Poland, and suddenly I saw down below on a road about 50 or 100 little lights moving along, bright lights. And I was, of course, convinced these were the border troops and they were alerted to catch me. And it turned out that they were the miners going to work at the Moravská Ostrava big coal mine, which was situated to the west of where we were crossing. And I had no difficulty in going to the farm, lying there overnight, and then going on a bus to Krakow.
What happened to you in Poland?
Well, I was reporting to refugee organizations to be listed, waiting for a ship or a plane to take me either to Sweden, which was more easy, or to England. And there I miscalculated, because there were long queues, endless delays in given documentation and a place on a boat, and the war started. I should mention here that an uncle of mine, same name, Gustav Wotzilka, was a surgeon, and when he knew that I planned to go illegally to Poland to reach England this roundabout way, he gave me the addresses of two or three of his former students who were established surgeons in Poland. And one of these addresses was in Krakow. Another one in the town of Brest-Litovsk, which later on was a life-saving address as far as my survival was concerned. Well, this doctor in Krakow was very helpful and also put me up, generally treated me extremely kindly and considerately. And one day, endless delays, week after week, and constant hope that tomorrow or next week I would finally be able to get away. One morning, I saw tiny little planes up in the sky, which I considered was one of the many exercises carried out by the Polish Air Force. But when they started dropping bombs, it was obvious that the war had started. I had heard that a Czech volunteer field ambulance was supposed to be created in the east of the country, because the west was bound to be overrun very quickly. And so by train and then later on foot, I moved with some other Czech refugees east. I cannot remember many details. One detail I remember was when we had left the train and were sort of walking through the hot sort of late summer countryside. We came to a fairly dry riverbed with a bridge, a small bridge going over it. And some of our possessions were on one or two carts, suitcases and so on, while this group of us went actually on foot through the riverbed over to the other side. And at that time, some dive bombers reached this river and blew up the bridge. There were none of us injured, which was, of course, tremendous good fortune, having left the carts and being a few hundred yards away from the bridge. But we lost all our possessions. I had only, after that, what I stood in, just my clothes. Well, I then had another bit of good fortune. I was trotting along one of those country lanes, and by that time there were only another one or two of us with me. Some just weren't able to keep up the sort of speed at which we walked. And a big touring car stopped on our side to ask the way. There were two or three sort of roads branching off there. And I had looked at a map and so on, and I tried to explain which way was going east towards Lodz. And then I had a brilliant idea, and I said, could you take me along too? And they did. And the people in the car, who I should think were high officials of some sort, they took me along 100 miles or so east. And that, of course, meant that I was temporarily well away from the potential area of fighting. By that time, I had become very hungry and had hardly any money or anything on me. And I went up to a farm and said, could they give me something to eat? And they said, well, we let you stay for a day or two and feed you up if you help us with the potato harvest, which I did. Then from then I went on and came to the little town of Brest-Litovsk, which I aimed at, because that was where I had an address of a local surgeon who, according to my uncle, was likely to be helpful. And he was indeed. He was most kind. But by the time I reached the town, the Germans had just occupied it. And they were just putting up notices on street corners everywhere that non-residents had to report to the German military authorities for documentation. Well, I said to this doctor and his family, well, it's kind of them to put me up for the night, but tomorrow I must report, you see, and that will be the end of it. They just will send me back. That's it, that's the end. I played and lost. Well, then the radio announced late at night that the German and Russian authorities had decided finally on the border, and that the town of Brest-Litovsk would be the furthest western outpost of the Russian occupation, which meant, of course, that posters went up to report to the Russian authorities as non-residents. And I was very pleased with it, because I knew that if I had to report to the German authorities, I would be in real trouble. So I waited for the Germans to go and for the Russians to come, which is one of those little snippets of memory which are very clear to me, because the Germans saw the Russians arrive. And later on I realized this was part of an intended maneuver by the Russian intelligence services. The Russians arrived, and they were in a pitiful state. They looked like an unkempt dad's army appearing. They had broken down lorries. They were ages from 15 to 60. They wore great coats which didn't fit them. They wore rifles which looked like from the First World War. They were a pitiful lot. And they were the German crack troops of their armored brigades, and they said to each other, well, look at that lot. Our fire brigade could deal with them, you know. Just look at them. and they were very, very sort of superior. Now, this was a gigantic deception, which later on made it quite clear to me, whatever the very deceitful Mr. Stalin had in mind, he was never a friend of the Germans. And when I later at any time dealt with Russian commissars and people, the standoff between Germany and Russia was a purely sort of a way of trying to deal with one problem after another. They tolerated each other, but there was never any question of the Russian population or the Russian authorities favoring the Germans, which will come quite clear when I tell you with my first encounter with the Russian authorities. I did in due course report to their military headquarters in Brest-Litovsk, and at the beginning it was what you would expect. I had to fill in some forms, and the difficulty was that though I spoke Czech and though we were on the border of Belorussia, White Russia, I spoke hardly any Russian, and understanding what they wanted was difficult at times. But at that time, 50 years ago, there was one thing in my favor. Traditionally, for generations, the Russian intelligentsia, if they learned a foreign language, it was French. English had then not the place it has now. France and French culture and French communication was making things possible. So they found a captain in a matter of minutes who spoke beautiful Parisian French, and he interviewed me. Now, the interesting thing then was my first encounter with the people who matter in Russia. Now, I told you about the dreadful sort of people who were supposed to be the average Russian occupation forces, and this was all really a kind of intended deception, because when I had my interview there, in due course I had to wait. You always have to wait. And then I was told to report somewhere else. My forms had preceded me. Now, my first experience then was with Russian discipline, which I thought didn't exist, having seen these lorries arrive. Now, in the British Army, there is the command at ease, command attention, and if you, as I later on, let's say, are a medical officer in the Brigade of Guards, then of course it isn't attention, it's chin! So, in the Russian army, there is the word pozor, which is attention, P-O-Z-O-R. So when I got to the barracks at the back there, you see, I had to sit down, and there was an NCO and